Accession number 10495, rule 1.
Mr. Jones, Rule 1, could you tell me how you came to be interested in politics in the first place?
Yes, I think I'm a natural political animal. I've been interested in politics ever since I was a boy, I could say ever since I was a child. I did grow up in a household in which my parents and took a lot of interest in the world around them. And then I went to a school, a progressive school of the 1930s period, Abbotsholm. Well, there's also a strong interest in politics among some of the teachers, notably the history master. And we had a political discussion group which met weekly. My own politics were always to the left. And while I was a boy, when I was about 14, the Left Book Club was founded, and I immediately joined the Left Book Club and read all the books which they put out. Relevant in this context is that one of their books was Pamdat's India Today, which told me everything I wanted to know about India. And so at that time I would have called myself a socialist. Then I became a communist. From 1938, when I was 16 years old, I considered myself a communist. And I still, when I was in the army, which is what we're going to talk about, although obviously I didn't have a party card being in the army, my opinions, what I considered myself, my beliefs, were those of a communist. And to jump ahead, I continued to be a communist until 1951, which was when, like so many other people, I saw a lot of flaws and left it.
When did you actually join the Communist Party?
Well, Communist Party, I was really only in for a short time as such. In 1942, which is when I was in London as a civilian before I was called up. In 1942, for some months, I was in the Communist Party. Then I was in the army for 4.5 years, and then I rejoined the party in 1947, and as I say, left in 51.
But you've been in the Young Communist League before?
I've been in the Young Communist League for a couple of years, yes, yes.
So you joined that in 4?
In 38, yes.
And which particular branch had you joined?
Well, we had a little branch at school. It was the Abbotsholm branch of the Young Communist League.
Were you the leading light in that? Were you the promoter of it?
I would say the leading light was someone who possibly you might even interview one day, and that is Chris Freeman, now Professor Chris Freeman at University of Sussex.
And what kind of activities did you carry out at school as a Communist League? Just a discussion group?
Mostly just a discussion group, yes. I mean, what could one do? Yeah.
Were there any other famous names in it?
No, I don't think there were any other famous names there. We put out a paper, which in fact was circulated to a number of different schools, and we had a conference once. The paper was called Schools Forward. It was in imitation of University Forward, which was then the journal of the University Labour Federation, which was really communist-dominated. We started a paper called Schools Forward, and that circulated to Dartington, Beedales, most of the progressive schools, and even a few of the public schools, St. Paul's, I remember. You know, we had contacts, we had a sort of network of contacts. And we had a one-day conference, actually, at my parents' home while my parents were away once in 1939.
When the war broke out, were you at all involved in the controversies in the Communist Party in the autumn of 1939 about what attitude to take towards the declaration of war?
Well, I spent the first 2 years of the war in the United States. I went to America. I was going with my mother on a holiday. It still seems to be extraordinary that anybody should have decided to have a holiday in America in August 1939, but at all events that was planned, and I went with my mother, and the war broke out a couple of days after we arrived in New York, Actually, I was in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean when the news of the Soviet-German pact came through over the radio bulletin, which, of course, was what caused all the heart-searching and distress among communists. And I had to figure it out all by myself. And I reached the conclusion that it was going to be an imperialist war and one should oppose the war. And that's what I thought. And I was in contact when I got New York. It was decided, my parents decided the best thing I should do was to stay in New York. I was only 17, I wasn't of military age in any case, and go to university, and I did. I went to New York University. I was there for 2 years, and during that time I was politically active with the American Student Union, which was a left-wing group, and I was opposed to the imperialist war. Not without some heart searchings, I must say. But anyway, I was, and then of course in June 41, when Hitler attacked the Soviet Union, it all became somewhat simpler. And so for two reasons, one because in my eyes the character of the war changed, so I was all for the war and wanted to fight in the war, and secondly because I was then 19 years old and old enough to be in the army. And so I came back to England then in 1941.
Did your attitude towards the war change at all in the summer of 1940, at the time of Dunkirk, with the fall of France and the threat of invasion to Britain?
Well, I was very worried and sort of wobbled. And I felt that there was a strong case for saying that the character of the war had changed, in that the menace of fascism had now become much greater, and that there was such a thing as a war of national defense. And what one could say was that Britain, after the war, fall of France with the threat of invasion, Britain was engaged in a war of national defense, and therefore one should support such a war. And I remember some quite intense arguments with other communists then, but ultimately I came into line and agreed that it was still an imperialist war.
How did you come to be in the forces?
Well, as soon as I came back to England, I was under the illusion that one only had to come back to England if one was the right age and one was whipped up by the army in a couple of days. And I was rather hoping, you know, I could get a week with my parents first. And so I went down to Sussex, where my parents were living, and stayed there. And to my surprise, nothing happened. I didn't hear anything from the army. So after a bit, I thought, well, I have to volunteer, so I go and volunteer, and I did volunteer. I volunteered for the Royal Armoured Corps. I rather liked the idea of being in tanks. And to my great surprise, I got a letter saying the Royal Armoured Corps was full up. There were no vacancies. I'd never heard of an army without vacancies before. So I volunteered for something else, and that turned out to be full up too. And it dawned on me that I was, as it were, putting a spanner in the works, that the correct thing to do was wait to be called up. You only made problems if you volunteered. So I thought, okay, I wait to be called up, however, it can't be long, but I must do something to help the war effort. So I got a job in a factory in London, which, as a matter of fact, was only a sort of enlarged garage which reconditioned army lorry engines. And I got a job there, and I thought I might be there for a month or two, and actually I was there for about 8 months, simply waiting for the call-up, and I finally got called up in November 42.
Did you experience any discrimination because of your politics in the army?
That's something one can never know, isn't it? First of all, I thought, after I'd gone through my training, I applied for officer selection board, and that's where I thought I'll get the discrimination. I'll probably never get through that. But in fact, I did get through it. So I became an officer. So clearly there wasn't any discrimination there. And I'm not aware of any discrimination until the summer of 1945, and perhaps it's worth telling this story. One of my father's friends was a gentleman called Paul Mars, M-A-Z-E, French, a long time lived in England, who was a painter, fairly well-known artist. But he also, he was a great snob, great social snob, and he had a lot of very high-level contacts, and among other things, he happened to be a long-standing personal friend of Winston Churchill. And when I came back to England, I'd been in the Normandy campaign, and then I was taken prisoner, as I was a prisoner of war. And then I came back to England shortly before the end of the war. And this gentleman, Paul Miles, said, look, you know, don't just stay an ordinary anti-tank officer. The war fighting's over anyway. Must make use of your abilities. You've been in Germany now, albeit as a prisoner. You must do something about it. You ought to be in the political section of army headquarters in Germany. And I can fix it. And he did apparently fix it. And I got, I'm not sure whether I ever got anything in writing, but yes, I think I did. My memory may be slightly at fault, but anyway, I was to be posted to the headquarters army on the Rhine, Army of the Rhine, the political section. And then I waited and waited, and I never, I waited for my travel orders, and I never got any travel orders. So I went to the War Office and said, what about this? And they said, the posting is cancelled. So I said, can you tell me why? And they said, no, we're not at liberty to tell you why. So this clearly was a political thing. The posting was cancelled. So then I thought, well, I'll go to Germany. I wanted to go to Germany by this time. Then I thought I'd go to Germany in ordinary military government. They were setting up the military government section, and I felt I had some qualifications. And I went for a board, and I passed the board quite definitely. I was told, yes, you passed the board, now you'll get your posting. And again, I never got my posting. All I got was a letter telling me to report to Royal Artillery Depot, Woolwich. So I was back as an anti-tank artillery officer, and I think there must have been a political veto in those two cases. And then something even more curious happened, namely that the adjutant at Woolwich, at the RA depot in Woolwich, told me, he said, as you're an ex-prisoner of war, you don't have to go abroad again, and I get you a posting at Lark Hill, nice quiet place in Wiltshire. And I said, no, I'd very much like to go to Germany, it'll be interesting. So he said, please yourself, I'll put you on a draft to go to Germany. And he put me on a draft, I was on this draft, and then quite accidentally, in a chat with another member of this draft, I found the draft was going to India, where I was appalled, I had no wish to go to India. And whether that was also a political interference, somebody had ordered, under no circumstances, is this man Jones to go to Germany, or whether, on the other hand, it was a perfectly straightforward military cock-up, I don't know and never shall know. But at all events, at the end of 45, I found myself on a ship to India.
It's always said by many people that it was the soldiers' vote in the famous election of 1945 that brought in the Labour government with such a massive majority. Did you find that amongst your comrades in the army and brother officers that there was a strong left-wing feeling?
Yes, I think that certainly is so. I think, well, of course, being an officer myself, I wasn't engaging in many, you know, frank chats with the other ranks to them. I was an officer. Mind you, even among the officers, there were sort of two types of officer. Well, you might say three types, and then there were obviously people who took no interest in politics at all. But there was the traditional, highly conservative officer, strongly represented in the senior ranks, of course. But there were also quite a lot of officers who had been radicalized by their war experiences, you know, and who were on the left. Among the soldiers, I'm pretty certain that the feelings were very, very strongly that we need a Labour government for a variety of reasons, partly because being in the army and being under the officers brought out their strong class feelings. I mean, the soldiers, they were working class. They had officers who were over them for no reason because they came from the upper ranks of society and were educated in a different way, although they might in fact be stupid or incompetent, but there they were, they became officers. Soldiers felt this. Also, of course, there was a strong feeling of we don't want to go back to the 30s, we don't want to go back to unemployment, the dole, and so on. So there was very the soldiers' vote, I think, went very solidly for having a Labour government. Well, certainly by the 45 election, when I was in England and talking to friends of mine who'd become journalists, it was pretty well widely agreed or taken for granted that the soldiers' vote was going to vote Labour almost en bloc.
How much of an influence do you think the alliance with the Soviet Union had?
Yes, it had some influence in shifting opinion, you know, generally to the left, not so much specifically in making people vote Labour. I don't think it was such strong influence as the other two factors which I've named. And incidentally, paradoxically, the soldiers' vote was a factor in ensuring that communists didn't get into parliament, because the communists had a chance, you know, in certain constituencies, and Harry Pollitt himself missed getting into parliament for the Rhondda by about 1,000 votes. The people at home, working class people at home, particularly in certain strongholds like South Wales and the Clyde, might be quite inclined to vote communist or to respond to communist campaign, you know, which in the constituency. Whereas the soldier abroad, however left-wing he might be, he probably wouldn't even know that there was a communist candidate in his home constituency, and he would just write to his dad or somebody and say, I'm giving you my proxy vote Labour.
Well, some people allege that organisations in the army, like the Army Bureau for Current Affairs, had a big influence in swaying soldiers' political opinions. What was your own personal experience on that?
Yes, I think so. Of course, the whole idea of political discussion in the army was anathema to the more conservative officers. They thought it was a terrible thing, and they thought that ABCA was a communist ramp. One or two of the pamphlets, I believe, were actually written by communists or, you know, by left-wing writers or by pro-Soviet people or anything like that. Most of them, of course, were not. They were just written by people who could write and who knew something about politics. But it was detested by the old ranks. And I know that my own battery, where I was a junior officer in the 6 months before D-Day in 59th Anti-Tank Regiment, the battery commander, who was a terribly nice man, as a matter of fact, whose background was in racing. His civilian life was running a racing stables, and he was a very traditional conservative English gent. And I wouldn't say he was a violent reactionary. He just thought that politics had no place in the army. And he hated the ABCA period, and he would always, if he possibly could, it was compulsory that there had to be this 1 hour of ABCA every week. And if he possibly could, he would ensure that there was some emergency or that there had to be a route march or something had to happen so it didn't take place.
Can you tell me about when you went to India eventually, the kind of impact it made on you?
Yes, I fell in love with India briefly on my first morning there on the train between Bombay and Delhi. I arrived absolutely seething. Or I don't know if I arrived seething. I boarded the ship seething because I'd wanted to go to Joni and I had absolutely no desire to go to India. I regarded it as a backwater where nothing interesting was going to happen. And in any case, the kind of Indians, I would find it very difficult to meet Indians, I could see, but the kind of Indians I would be in sympathy with would be the kind of Indians who would most distrust me as a Saab and someone in the service of imperialism and so on. So I'd find myself occupying a very invidious role. And anyhow, I wasn't terribly interested. All my interests were with European countries. During the journey, I talked to a few people who knew India very well, And I thought, well, you know, maybe it's really going to be very interesting. There was one man on the ship, a civilian, a teacher, I think, who had known Gandhi personally and who knew a great deal about... I'm sorry to say that I absolutely can't recall the name. But I had long talks with him walking around the deck. He told me a great deal of also about Indian history, culture, and so on. You know, the caste system, untouchability, how it had come about historically, and so on. So I worked up an interest there. So I arrived in a sort of ambivalent mood, and then taking this long, slow train journey up from Bombay to Delhi, and looking at these throngs of Indians, looking at the beautiful landscape, and then looking at this extremely colourful scene of women in saris and people in different kinds of costumes and turbans and one thing and another. India really took hold of my imagination, and I thought, well, I'm going to get extremely interested in this, as indeed I did. And I was in India a year and a quarter eventually before I was demobbed, and always retained my fascination for India. And in fact, I've retained it throughout the whole of my life and managed to go back there about 6 times.
Did you make contact with political Indians?
Yes.
Soon after getting there?
Yes, I did. Yes. I was in Delhi for about 3 months, and I made contact with a couple of other communists who were at Delhi. One who's extremely relevant to this story about the Forces Parliament, and that's Bert Ramelson. Have you interviewed Bert Ramelson?
I have indeed, yes.
You have indeed. Well, you know the story from his side. Not quite sure how I met him, actually, but anyhow I did at Delhi. And he had rather... I was in a tent, of course, and he had rather comfortable bungalow, which he was entitled as a staff captain legal. And he asked if I would like to share the bungalow, which I did, so we were rooming together. And he had already made contact with the Communist Party of India in Bombay, and it was easy to go down to Bombay at a weekend. As far as I remember, there was no formality. One just went. And so we went to... what they used to call, in rather military style, PHQ, Party Headquarters, which, by a further strange coincidence, was in Sandhurst Road. And that was the head office of the Communist Party of India, Bombay. They welcomed British comrades. It never seemed to occur to them that... there might be anything strange about our going there, or that we might be not what we said we were. They took it for granted we were real communists, which, as far as I know, we all were. And Bert and I were asked sometimes to sit in. There used to be a weekly, I think on Saturdays, there used to be a staff meeting, that is, of the full-timers of the CPI, where they would discuss political issues and policy and so on, and we were quite welcome to sit in on it, which we did. And so I got to know S.A. Dange, party chairman. I think I'm right in saying that I already met Dange in about November 45 in London. Yes, I think so, through King Street. I got to know Dange, Dr. Adhikari, who was the party's main... theoretician, intellectual, Randive, who was later to be the leader of the Communist Party Marxist, one or two others.
What impression did Indian communists make on you as compared with what you've been used to with British communists?
I admired them very much, as a matter of fact. I thought they were full of intelligence. And full of, this is one of the things, one of the great impressions I got about in talking to Indians in that period was the great Indian subtlety of mind and the Indian love of minute analysis and so on. and what one of my Indian friends calls the Brahminical mind, the love of introducing infinite complications into anything. And of course, someone who has this mental outlook is really made to order for Marxism, because Marxism also, you know, has that way of thinking. So there are absolutely wonderful discussions on what I thought a very high theoretical level. I thought people like Dange and Adhikari were at a theoretical level, sort of way above anybody I'd met in England. In the British Communist Party, one tended to have people of working class origin, whom I did indeed like and admire. I admired Harry Pollitt very much. But there were these group of people, you know, Pollitt, Gallagher, Springhill, others in the British Communist Party, who had qualities of courage, devotion, dedication, all that sort of thing, but who were no great intellectual whiz kids and tended to put a very sort of narrow-minded, simplistic line politically, you know, and were not terribly interesting to talk to. And I found that the Indians were quite different from that.
Now, in the army itself at Dulali, can you tell me about the Forces Parliament there and how you first came into contact with it?
Yes, the Forces Parliament already existed when I arrived. I must have arrived about the third week of January, I think. Of 46. And it already existed, and I must have got to know about it almost at once, you know, through notice board or somebody mentioned it to me, I don't know. So I went along, and unlike the Cairo Forces Parliament, which I understand was elected, the Dulali Forces Parliament was never elected. It was open to anybody. If you went along, you were automatically an MP, you were automatically a member. And of course it had rather a floating population, because people got posted in and posted out. And also some people weren't interested in coming to every session. I can't precisely remember how often it met. I think about twice a week. And I couldn't tell you precisely how many members it had. My sort of visual memory of the room is that about 100, I should say, about 100 there. Now, of these, there were a very few officers. Bert Ramelson and myself, we were officers, and the education officer, the young man who had the official